This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we begin today on Beacon Hill, where the legislature is tackling the state budget 6 months later because of COVID-19. And with so much at stake this year, they could be taking up some policy changes that go beyond the dollars and cents. Well, WBUR's Steve Brown is there. He joins us on the line now. Welcome back, Steve.
Hi, Tiziana.
So I know there's a lot. Can you give us an overview? Tell us what's on the table and what's the latest?
Sure. They're slowly going through their blueprint to spend $46 billion. Now, most of the discussion that's been going on about amendments takes place on Zoom, just among the members. The public isn't allowed to watch. I've been watching the session on a TV screen here in my office, and for most of the day, they have been in a recess. Now, I'm watching because there could be some interesting amendments ahead. We just have no idea when they're going to come up.
So I referenced this six-month delay due to COVID. How's that affecting things, Steve?
Yeah, normally they'd be having this debate back in April. The House does it in April. The Senate would do it in May. They'd come up with a compromise in June. And then July 1st would be the beginning of the fiscal year. Well, of course, they couldn't gather back then because of the pandemic. Also, there was a lot of uncertainty over the economy and how much, if any, aid the state would be getting from Washington. So legislators who write the budget say that this delay was actually time well spent because now they have a better handle on state finances. They know that they can dip into some one-time revenues to balance the budget with the hopes that revenues will be a little bit better next year.
You mentioned there could be some interesting amendments ahead. I understand there are 777 budget amendments. They cannot all be created equally. So what are the major things to look out for?
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of amendments, and it is. They still have, I just did a rough count, they've disposed of about a little over 300 of them. They got 420 to go. Most of them are more symbolic amendments that gives legislators a chance to say that they asked for a certain amount of money to benefit their district. Most of them wind up getting withdrawn or just not included in the final version. They did overwhelmingly vote down an amendment the other day from Mike Conley of Cambridge that would have raised taxes on unearned income. Only 30 of the House's most progressive members went along with that. But there are a couple of more amendments in the hopper that I'm still keeping an eye out for.
I want to take a closer look at one of those. Our listeners might not expect that there's an amendment, a budget amendment to the Roe Act, which would codify abortion rights into state law and make abortions legal after 24 weeks under certain circumstances. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah, as you say, it would update the legal language governing abortions in state law. Supporters of the Roe Act and of this amendment say that the state laws relating to abortion were written back in the 1970s, soon after Roe versus Wade. And they say that language is outdated and doesn't reflect the proper medical or scientific terms. This would update that. Groups opposed to abortion say that the procedure is accessible in Massachusetts. There was a hearing on this bill over a year ago, and the president of Mass Citizens for Life said that this legislation is to fix something that isn't broken, adding it solves nothing and is a reckless reaction to the far right. The language allows abortions after 24 weeks in more cases, not just to save the life of a mother, but allows a doctor to determine, and this is the language here, lethal fetal anomaly incompatible with sustained life outside the uterus. It also would create a process for women under the age of 16 to secure the procedure without parental consent. They'd have to go before a judge. Currently, the law is 18 years. This amendment pretty much mirrors a separate bill that would do the same thing. I think the House leadership wants to include it in the budget for expediency's sake so that they don't have to deal with it in a standalone bill. Now, I'm hearing a similar budget amendment will be filed over in the Senate when they debate the budget next week.
Steve, this begs the question, if the confirmation to the Supreme Court of now Justice Amy Coney Barrett added a sense of urgency to this or is driving this.
Yeah, I definitely think that was the impetus to get this done up here. It has pretty broad support in the heavily Democratic legislature, and the latest SCOTUS appointment was just the push that it needed to get it going here in the building.
All right, let's stay with this relationship between what's happening in the State House and national governance and politics. Joe Biden is the projected president-elect. There's speculation about Senator Elizabeth Warren as a possible Treasury Secretary. I understand that one of these 777 amendments, which is proposed by Amherst Democrat Mindy Dohm, would prevent Republican Governor Charlie Baker from appointing someone from a party other than Warren's to fill her seat if that seat should open up. So I want to ask about that. The basis for it, does it have a lot of support?
I'm not sure if it has a lot of support, but it is a fascinating amendment, especially for political wonks like myself. And I guess I'd include you in there too, Tiziana.
Thank you.
It states,
badge of
as
honor.
You said, it states that the governor would need to appoint someone from that same party as the person who left, causing the vacancy. Now, as the law is written now, the governor gets to make an interim appointment if there is a vacancy in the U.S. Senate. Now, that appointment gets to serve roughly 6 months in the U.S. Senate until a special election is held. Now, this wasn't a concern the last two times when then-Governor Deval Patrick, a Democrat, appointed Democrats to fill vacancies, once after Ted Kennedy died, and the second time when John Kerry became Secretary of State. Now, with Republican Governor Charlie Baker getting to make that pick, should one be needed, well, we don't even know if one's going to be needed
right.
yet, some fear that he could appoint a Republican to fill that temporary position, giving the GOP an extra seat in the already closely split U.S. Senate. Now, I've been asking around, and I'm not hearing that this amendment is gaining a lot of traction, but we'll just have to wait and see.
Somebody posed the question to me today, if the governor could appoint himself, doesn't seem like something he'd do, but could he?
Yeah, he could. Simple as that, he could.
There you go.
You know, the thing is, he would still have to be subject to that special election. So he'd appoint himself temporarily, and presumably if he were to do that, then he would throw his hat in the ring to be the Republican nominee in the special election. He would have to win that. If he didn't win that, he'd be out of a job.
So I do want to ask, let's move beyond the budget work now. There are other legislative items sort of sitting with the State House. I'm thinking specifically of the police reform bill, which has been in process since July. What's going on with other legislation?
Sure, police reform, health care, climate change, just to name a few. They're all holed up in conference committee, and conference committee members are very tight-lipped about what's going on behind closed doors. I'll reach out to them periodically, and they won't even let me know if they're meeting. I would suspect that as the House and the Senate are finishing up the budget this month, those bills will probably start popping from conference committees. It's just an up or down vote. There's no changes that can be made. So then if accepted, the bill would then go onto the governor's desk for his signature.
All right, we just touched a minute ago on Governor Charlie Baker and the national elections. I want to go back there because the governor condemned President Trump's challenge to the election results. You were in the room when he said it. Here it is.
I'm dismayed to hear the baseless claims coming from the president, from his team, and from many other elected Republican officials in Washington. This latest move to employ the Department of Justice in all of this is so wildly inappropriate. And stalling an orderly transition process, especially at a time like this, is equally unacceptable.
Steve, that seems to me to be surprising from the governor, given sort of how even-keeled he is, his record on comments on the president. Is it surprising to you?
It was. I tweeted out during that statement that it was the most full-throated condemnation of anything that Donald Trump has done from Charlie Baker. Baker has been extremely careful not to make his criticisms personal, but you can tell he is fed up with baseless allegations from President Trump and his supporters that Joe Biden is not yet president-elect.
Well, that's WBUR reporter Steve Brown. I appreciate you checking in with us from the State House. Steve, thanks.
Thank you, Tiziana.
We turn now to the city of Boston, which will pay $3.1 million to Frederick Clay, a man who was wrongfully convicted of murder and imprisoned for nearly 4 decades. While not publicly released, the settlement was reportedly reached in July. So joining us with more is WBUR's Allie Jarmanning. Allie, welcome back to the show.
Hello.
So I want to start with who Frederick Clay is and what happened to him. Allie, tell us.
Yeah, Fred Clay was 16 in 1979 when he was arrested and charged with the death of a cab driver in Boston. And he was convicted on the testimony of a witness who only identified Clay after a Boston police detective put him under hypnosis. Clay spent 38 years in prison until 2017 when his conviction was vacated. And prosecutors at the time said Clay was clearly innocent. This $3.1 million from the city of Boston is actually the second settlement for Clay. He received $1 million from the state in 2019 under a state law that compensates those wrongfully convicted. And what's really interesting about the Boston settlement is that Clay didn't have to file a lawsuit to get it, which usually is the case in situations like this.
It also struck me, Allie, that when that settlement happened, it was in July, which was roughly the same time period that we saw protests going on around the country over the Minneapolis police killing of George Floyd. Is there a sense that that may have had an effect on the outcome here?
Yeah, I've reviewed a lot of cases of police misconduct, and when a payout is made, it's almost always because a lawsuit is filed or the city settles or a jury rules awards damages to the person suing. But this case is striking because Clay never got to the lawsuit filing stage. This was the only case in 10 years that I saw that didn't start with a lawsuit. So I asked Clay's attorney, Emma Freudenberger, and she says she thinks the willingness to settle is because cities are increasingly aware of the risk posed by taking cases to trial.
Juries recognize first that wrongful convictions happen. Second, that wrongful convictions happen because of police misconduct. And third, that when wrongful convictions happen, the damage that they do to a person's life is just extraordinary.
$3.1 million sounds like a big number, Allie, is it?
It's definitely big, but it is not the biggest in Boston in recent memory. Back in 2014, the city paid another wrongfully convicted man, that's Sean Drumgold, $5 million. Drumgold had spent 15 years in prison for the killing of a 12-year-old girl. And another man who was wrongfully convicted, James Haley, was awarded $3 million in 2013 after spending 34 years in prison on a murder charge.
Allie, can you give us some context, let's say, in terms of how many times Boston has paid out for claims related to police misconduct, how much money the city has paid out? How much are we talking about?
So over the last decade, Boston has paid more than $15 million to deal with police misconduct claims. And many of those are settlements. Those are before a case goes to trial, but a handful are payments made after a jury found the city responsible. And these cases include wrongful convictions like Clay's, excessive force, false arrest, even defamation. And some of those officers accused have since left the force, but many are still working.
That is WBUR's Allie Jarmanning. Allie, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And as we said before the break, the second surge is here.
The trends obviously are going in the wrong direction and show no sign of changing.
That's Governor Baker on Tuesday referring to a significant uptick in coronavirus cases in Massachusetts. At the same time, there was promising news this week as Pfizer, a pharmaceutical company, announced that their experimental COVID-19 vaccine was more than 90% effective in the first batch of data for their phase 3 clinical trials. So let's talk about the latest on the coronavirus with a panel of medical experts. And you can call us. What do you need to know? Whether that's about the timing and availability of the vaccine, hospital capacity, sources of the current spread, call us with any of your questions. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So joining us now for this conversation is Dr. Christopher Gill, an infectious disease clinician and researcher who focuses on vaccines and the epidemiology of respiratory diseases. He's also an associate professor at the BU School of Public Health. We also have Dr. Paul Sachs. He is the clinical director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Brigham and Women's Hospital and a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. Doctors Gill and Sachs, welcome to both of you.
Pleasure to be here.
Thanks for inviting us. Thanks.
All right, so Dr. Sachs, I'll start with you. Cases are up. State officials confirmed 1,840 new cases of the coronavirus yesterday. At the height of the first wave in the spring, we were seeing around 2,300 a day. We have gotten close to that number in the last few days. The governor has confirmed that we're in the second wave. So what's your reaction to the numbers that we've been seeing and where we are?
Well, the numbers are up for a few reasons. One is that we're testing a lot more, and that means that the people being diagnosed have a wider range of illness. Some of them are quite sick and in the hospital, but many of them are quite well and still in the community. So that's one reason why the numbers are up. The other reason is that some of the very careful social distancing we were doing, and that was more easily done in the summertime when we were outdoors more, has not come to an end, but has been reduced. You know, when the weather gets cold, people move inside and there's just much more interaction, and that we know that that's how this virus spreads. So indoor activities are predominantly where they spread, and indoor activities are going to be more common as the weather gets colder.
So Dr. Gill, I'm going to turn to you, because at the same time, what we haven't seen is a significant spike in deaths from COVID-19 the way we did in the spring. At the height, we were seeing over 180 deaths a day. I want to note the number's now hovering around 20, and any death is a death too many. But I want to play some sound from Carlisle Public Schools today. Governor Baker was there at a press conference saying the state is more prepared for this fall surge.
We're nowhere near the uncharted territory we were at in the spring. Nowhere near it. Nowhere. We are definitely dealing with a surge that we talked about throughout the summer and the beginning of the fall, and we're currently the largest per capita tester in the United States.
How does this, what seems to be a reduction in the death rate, relate to that preparedness, or what else is going on?
Yeah, so I completely agree with what Paul just said a moment ago about the increased testing rates, because that actually is clearly playing a role here. Because if we look back to, you know, earlier in the spring, we were seeing test positivity rates in the 5-7% range, and at the same time we were seeing very high hospitalization rates and lots of people were dying, as we all recall those terrible months in the beginning. And you know, what we were almost certainly seeing there, reflected in the testing numbers, was that we were preferentially testing a sicker sort of stratum of the population. We were testing for cause because people were coming into the hospital sick and were being diagnosed with COVID-19, whereas now, you know, we're doing mass asymptomatic screening. I took my daughters to Revere, to the parking lot behind Revere High School the other day, where we all sat in our SUVs and waited to be tested one after another. And so the way that we're looking for the disease is fundamentally different. But even with that said, it's also inescapable that the COVID numbers are rising. And about a month ago, I think I discussed this issue with some of your colleagues. And at that time, the hospitalization rate had stayed pretty low, but that is also rising too. So we're not just seeing sort of an abstract number of rising cases solely due to you know, our better testing capacity, but also because the transmission rates are definitely on the rise themselves, but not to the level that we saw in the spring so far.
All right, so Dr. Gill, Dr. Sachs, the calls are coming in already, so I'm going to turn there. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to ask your coronavirus question. We've got Bennett on the line from North Andover. Bennett, go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a teacher in Massachusetts, and it seems like right now many districts are trying to avoid going remote at all costs and, in fact, are working in the opposite direction to try to get students back full time. I'm wondering, from a professional standpoint, what is your opinion on reopening schools during the middle of a spike like this?
Dr. Sachs, would you like to start?
Sure. I think it's important that we consider schools based on the age of the students. It does appear that younger children are both less likely to get very sick with COVID-19 themselves, and also, based on multiple studies, less likely to transmit it. We can contrast this with the older students, in particular, the older teen students and the young adult students in universities, and there they have very, very high rates of infection. So, where possible, I think it does make sense to try to keep schools open, especially at that younger ages, and to do so with as many mitigation strategies as possible to make it as safe as possible. So, you know, there's a real societal cost to closing schools, and if we work together, I think we can make opening schools safe.
Dr. Gill, is there anything you want to add on that?
Well, I fully agree with Paul again on that point. I think there's such a huge social benefit in so many ways to having the schools open. And I really feel like that needs to be the number one priority above all other considerations. We need to keep the schools open. And I would add that, you know, we I think we are promoting mitigation strategies in all sorts of ways. You know, we're asking the students to socially distance, to wear masks, the faculty to wear masks. We're in some cases modifying the airflow within school buildings to increase filtration rates. Some teachers are putting HEPA filters in their rooms. Some may also be using UV filters. So we're doing all sorts of things to de-densify, to distribute the population, to maybe have alternating, you know, schooling. So half the students are present in school on every other week to reduce the transmission burden in the state. But the one thing that we're not systematically doing, with the possible exception of some of the universities, is systematic testing of asymptomatics. And I really do feel very strongly that we should be doing that, particularly in the higher transmission zones. And while I realize that there are significant resource implications to that, I think that, you know, if you think of all the efforts that we're going through in terms of risk mitigation and controlling transmission, the one thing is missing is evidence that we're succeeding. We have no barometer of success or failure. And so we're, in a sense, acting, you know, we're going into this blind. And that, to me, seems really, really a pity.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Stephen on the line from Hingham. Stephen, what's your question?
Thanks for taking my call. On October 25th, the Globe reported that the source of 50% of Massachusetts infections were unknown, meaning that 50% were known. Of the known sources, 30 to 37% were intra-household. The remaining 15 to 20% are ascribed to, quote, cluster-driven transmission like restaurants, schools, and private events. I'd assume that the 15 to 20% are reasonably representative of the unknown 50%. What are the details of this 15 to 20%? How much is gyms, restaurants, schools, et cetera? It seems like there's a lot of detail there that could inform how we manage the pandemic, but they just haven't shared the details.
Dr. Sachs, what do we know?
Well, there was a very interesting CDC study that came out that looked at cell phone data and tried to provide us with some better guidance about which were the riskiest activities. And really, number one are restaurants. And it's sad for me to say that because, you know, I love restaurants and I love going out to eat, but this is not the time to go out to eat in restaurants. I think we need to support our restaurants in other ways by doing takeout and, you know, but not eating indoors. That really is definitely something that is high-risk activity. So restaurants in particular, and then other sites where things like gyms and gyms in particular that have older ventilation or are crowded, and also, unfortunately, houses of worship and schools. If we were to prioritize which are most important for us as a society, I would agree that keeping the schools open is more important than keeping those other activities open, although everything is important. It's just a matter of can we try to avoid the biggest impact transmission sites, and restaurants and bars again and again come up as high risk.
You're listening to Radio Boston, where we're taking your coronavirus calls with Drs. Paul Sachs and Christopher Gill. The number for your question is 1-800-423-8255. We have Catherine on the line from Norfolk. Catherine, go ahead.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call. I'm calling because I come from a multi-generational family. We have kids in elementary school, middle school, high school, college. And everyone lives here in Massachusetts, but we are all in disagreement on how to celebrate Thanksgiving. My parents, who are in their late 70s, want to host Thanksgiving and want us to come. And I don't feel comfortable doing that, but other people in the family say that we should do it and we should honor their wishes. So I just want to know what the doctors think about that.
Catherine, thanks. And Dr. Gill, I'm going to turn to you, but I want to play a little sound to go along with Catherine's question, because the governor was a little more specific about where he's concerned with private gatherings today than I've heard him recently. He was referencing today a Washington Post article at this press conference he held in Carlisle. It's about what's causing the vast majority of the spread in the U.S. Here he is.
Dinner parties, game nights. It's the stuff I've been talking about for months now. Small, informal, casual gatherings with a bigger circle of friends than people were spending time with back at the beginning of the summer.
Seems like Catherine's question is about that bigger circle, this time family, not friends. What's your guidance for her?
It's a really important question, Catherine. And I don't think there's a very palatable answer. Except that to say that when we say, what is it about, you know, going to a bar that increases the risk? You know, the answer is really simple. It's risky because you're bringing lots of people together in close proximity for extended periods of time. They're probably talking loudly and therefore generating lots of aerosols. And, you know, they're drinking and engaging in social interactions, which are both sort of incompatible with masks, if you will. And they're in an enclosed airspace. And so it is really the perfect setting in which to transmit a respiratory virus of any kind. The only thing that distinguishes that from a Thanksgiving gathering is that you know all the people. And so I suppose there could be some comfort, you know, if everybody had been tested in advance. But that is very hard to really rest on in terms of having a high margin of safety, I would say. And the consequences, I think, if you can sort of imagine a worst case scenario coming out of this, where, you know, this you know, treasured family tradition leads to someone being hospitalized or possibly even dying. I can't imagine the sort of the psychological damage that would do to a family in terms of feeling guilty in perpetuity. So it just seems like it's a risk that is probably not worth taking. Unless somehow the weather, you know, conspired to be warm and unseasonably balmy, and the entire thing could be done outdoors. In that case, maybe you could justify this. But if this is an extended indoor dinner with lots of elderly relatives, it just seems to me like this is a very dangerous plan.
Thanks for that. Dr. Sachs, did you want to add?
Yeah, I think if you asked most infectious disease specialists the size of their planned Thanksgiving gathering this year, it would be very small. And feel free to ask me what mine will be.
So what will yours be?
It will be my wife and my son and myself, and plus our dog and cat. Really do.
Of course.
Do, I mean, and I have family that I would really love to see, and I feel for everybody, and we're going to miss that this year. But now that we have this exciting vaccine news, I think if we think about a light at the end of the tunnel, maybe not just with this one vaccine, but multiple vaccines, then this is a year we should sacrifice a big gathering.
I'm into that.
All right. There you go. 800-423-8255. Let's pick up John in Cambridge.
Well, yes. Hi, thank you. In support of opening up the schools, I heard your guest cite, quote, multiple studies indicating a relatively low risk threshold in the schools. My understanding is that those studies are quite partial, incomplete, and by no means unequivocal. Which specific studies are you talking about?
Dr. Sachs, that was you, so I'll turn back to you.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt that there are studies that show that transmission can happen from children to adults. And what we're really talking about is not risk elimination, but risk mitigation. And there are all real downsides also to having children not go to school at all. So we're looking at trade-offs. And by and large, the highest risk people for transmission of the virus are young adults. And it's lower for children than it is.
Okay, let's take a couple calls. We'll go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. We've got Patty on the line from Westwood. Patty, what's your question?
Hi there. My question is regarding the Pfizer vaccine that is proposed to come out. When they say it's effective, certain percentage effective, what does that mean? Is it effective to stop the virus? Is it effective, you know, I guess I don't understand what that means without knowing details.
Thanks for that question, Patty. We've got another vaccine question. I'm going to get it too, and then I'll turn to both of you, Drs. Sachs and Dr. Gill. Jennifer's on the line from Everett. Jennifer, I think you have a vaccine question as well.
Yes, I have a question regarding vaccine distribution. I fully respect that frontline workers and possibly the elderly would be in line before me, but I am a cancer survivor, and I'm just wondering where I would possibly fall into, you know, which phase I would possibly be able to receive the vaccine.
Okay, thanks for that, Jennifer. So, Dr. Gill, I'll turn to you with Patty's question first, which is, you know, 90% efficacy with their first batch of data out of the phase 3 trial. What does that actually mean? What does efficacy mean here, and what do we take from that?
Yeah, I have to agree with Patty that the information that we got in the press release from Pfizer was a bit enigmatic. So what we were told was that the efficacy was based on the number of individuals who are identified as having COVID in the vaccine group versus the unvaccinated control group. And so that's what led them to say that there was a 90% reduction in infections. And so while that is reading a little bit into the tea leaves to some degree, because you know we only have that sort of rather broad statement, it does signal to me that we're talking about people being infected with COVID-19. Now, whether that was individuals who were identified because they were symptomatic and were thus tested and found to be positive, or whether this was based on some sort of systematic screening, so they looked at the whole population, you know, with repeated nasopharyngeal sampling over time, and then eventually found, you know, the numbers who became infected in the two groups. That was not clear in the press release, but it's a very important question. Because one would like to know whether the vaccine is equally effective across the full spectrum of disease. Does it have an easier time protecting against mild disease versus severe disease? That's an excellent question. And of course, there are a number of other unknowns that I think really so tantalizing. How well does it work across the age spectrum? You know, do we have equal efficacy in the elderly or those with chronic medical conditions versus the young, hale, and hearty? That was not revealed.
Thank you. And I'm going to turn to you then, Dr. Sachs, for Jennifer's question. You know, she was asking about kind of who's queued up in distribution. I believe that roughly phase one of distribution in Massachusetts, we're planning for 20,000 to 60,000 doses. She's a cancer survivor and wanted to know where she might be in the lineup.
Well, one thing that has been going on behind the scenes, which is really excellent, is that the CDC has providing guidance for distribution of COVID-19 vaccines. And they specify the four groups to be prioritized, which would be healthcare personnel, non-healthcare essential workers, not otherwise defined, and the states will define that. And then in that categories also are adults with high-risk medical conditions. And so, you know, there are a variety of high-risk medical conditions that have been described for more severe COVID-19. It depends on the form of cancer that would whether one would qualify. And then the last category, of course, is people 65 years of age or older, because the elderly consistently in study after study after study have more severe disease. So that would be the first round of immunizations. But we hope, we infectious disease doctors are big fans of effective vaccines. We hope that pretty soon there'll be enough vaccine production for anyone who wants it.
When you say pretty soon, what do you imagine in your mind, Dr. Sachs?
Well, there's another study that is due to read out data within the coming week. I think we heard yesterday that they've had enough cases in the Moderna vaccine study to be able to say whether they have some signal of efficacy. And there are at least 8 other studies in quite advanced stages of investigation. And so we could have multiple vaccines available in the calendar year 2021. And the key then will be all of the logistics of distribution and then, of course, societal acceptance.
All right. We've got time for maybe at least one, maybe two. Let's start with one more call. We've got Luis on the line from Brookline. Luis, go ahead.
I am a board of director of the soccer league, adult soccer league, where we have about 275 soccer teams, more than 4,000 players, and we are playing. And even when we put very strict guidelines about wearing masks and all that, people are not really obeying to the guidelines. How dangerous is that? Like, what should we do in order to prevent more spreading?
Great question. Mm-hmm. Dr. Gill, do you want to, is that you I hear there?
Yes. I assume, Luis, that you're talking about outdoor soccer, in which case I think the data are pretty clear that the risk of transmission out of doors is really quite low. And I think one of the things that's really important to emphasize is that, you know, we tend to think in a very simple way about the transmission patterns of this virus as being either, you know, you're exposed or you're not exposed. But I think that's too simple, because really it's a matter of like the amount of the dose of the vaccine, of the virus that you were exposed to over time matters a great deal in terms of whether you become sick or whether you become infected. And if you become infected, what the severity of your illness was. So while I understand that, you know, in a vigorous game of soccer, people are going to be, you know, shoving up against each other and pushing hard, and will be in intimate contact for a few seconds at a time and breathing heavily. Even so, I think the risk that presents is probably extremely low. And if you're also wearing a mask as much as you can, I think you've taken all reasonable steps. So I think that what you're doing is not unreasonable.
All right, let's try to get one more quick call and answer in. Luke from Cambridge. Luke, quickly, please.
I'm concerned that a coronavirus test too soon after a perceived exposure gives you a negative result, would give you a false sense of security. Doesn't it take a certain amount of time to build up a big enough load to read in a test, and shouldn't you continue to quarantine?
Good question. And Dr. Sachs, can you do a brief answer to that?
Sure. I mean, the answer to your question is yes. A single negative test done too soon after an exposure does not eliminate the chance that the person will get COVID-19 and be potentially contagious to others. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't do the testing. And really what I've been advising people who are having kids coming back from the universities is to get tested before they leave, preferably after a period of 5 to 7 days of reducing social interactions, and then test it again once they arrive. And a couple of tests done, in fact, repeated testing is definitely, the models show that it is much more accurate than just a single test. But you're absolutely right to raise that concern.
Well, this has been great. That's Dr. Paul Sachs, the clinical director of the Division of Infectious Diseases at Brigham and Women's, and Dr. Christopher Gill, an infectious disease clinician and researcher, also at the BU School of Public Health. Thanks to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for the invitation to join you today.
North Atlantic right whales are dying out, and at a faster rate than we thought. According to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, some 366 whales total remain, about 94 reproductive females, despite decades of conservation efforts. And these numbers represent an 11% drop from the previous estimate. So we wondered some things. Why is this whale so close to extinction? And what do we lose if the North Atlantic right whale goes the way of the dodo and so many other lost species? So let's ask Peter Corcoran. He is the senior scientist and the chair of marine mammal conservation of that program at the New England Aquarium. Peter, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, thanks very much for having me, Tiziana.
So we've heard a lot about saving whales for decades now, particularly here in New England around the right whale. And at least for some years, it kind of seemed like maybe the numbers were rising. Clearly now not the case. What is going on, Peter?
Yeah, well, I mean, they were rising through to about 2010. You know, the right whales have been coming back from being hunted for centuries, and they're probably at really low numbers at the start of, you know, the 2000s, the start of 1900s. And, you know, we saw them increase. We know that from 1990 to 2010, they're increasing at a bit over 2% a year. And then 2010, 2011, they peaked, and since then they've been in decline. So they maxed out at a bit under 500, and now they're, you know, between 350 and 400.
So were we doing something right up until 2010 that we stopped doing after that?
Well, a couple of things went on. I mean, one is, obviously, if you stop whaling, that's really good for whales. And so that was a big step in the right direction. But, you know, North Atlantic right whales were never actually increasing as well as they probably could have. You know, instead of that 2% or so a year, they probably could have increased at about 4%. And they didn't, because we were still killing them. But we weren't killing them in such numbers that they were in decline. They were just sort of creeping upwards. You know, the southern right whales, their cousins from the Antarctic, increase at between 5 and 7% a year, which is appreciably better than North Atlantic rights are doing. So they could have done better. But then around 2000 or so, a few things happened. They've changed their behavior somewhat. The waters of the Gulf of Maine are warming quite fast, and that's affected where right whales can eat. And so they've moved out a bit, and they've gone to, one of the places they've gone to is the Gulf of St. Lawrence. And when they first went there, people weren't expecting them there, and that led to quite a few deaths. And then the other thing is, you know, that we've changed the way we work in the ocean. And that's made it, you know, more likely that some things endanger them more or hurt them more. And it's both a matter of them dying and them being debilitated. And that's just got worse in the past decade or so.
What does that mean, we've changed the way we work in the ocean?
Oh, things like the ropes that are used in fishing gear has got a lot stronger, you know, because we've got better quality ropes. And, you know, some fishing's had to move further offshore, so I had to use stronger ropes. And, you know, a big problem for right whales is getting entangled in fishing gear. And the stronger the rope is, the harder it is for the whales to deal with. And you know, that can just lead them to be, you know, crippled and die excruciatingly painful deaths.
That is really disturbing. It makes me think about the challenges that we have here in the area with the lobster industry as well. I know that, you know, buoy lines can kill the right whale, but the lobster industry has also been hit really hard. As you said, warming waters have hit the industry. They've had to move out further. They're pushing back, of course, on limits to lines or changing how they catch lobsters. That can be expensive. How do we, can we protect the industry and the right whale? Is this a death match, or is there a way to support both?
Well, there should be a way to support both. I mean, this isn't, you know, one of these really, really difficult problems like solving climate change. You know, this is, we know enough about right whales and the problems they're facing to know what we need to do. And it's really a matter of will. It's a matter of deciding, we're going to come up with a solution. We can do this. Let's all just work together and make it happen.
Does that mean things like helping the fishing industry with financial support to change to ropeless fishing? Is it changing, you know, patterns of ships? What are those solutions?
It's exactly those sorts of things you're talking about. You know, we know that getting ships to slow down to 10 knots helps a lot. And at the moment, there's places where that's obliged to happen and places where ships are just asked to do it. You know, we need to rethink what those areas are and how long they're in place, whether they should include vessels of less than 65 feet, which is a cutoff point at the moment. You know, a 62-foot boat can kill a whale as well. You know, and then with fishing gear, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of work going on to try and resolve, you know, the entanglement problem. And you know, we know what the solutions can be. We just have to decide that we want to implement them, and that's a social decision. You know, what are we prepared to do to help the fishing industry to change their practices?
I want to go back. So let me backtrack first. We're talking with Peter Corcoran from the New England Aquarium about the North Atlantic right whale and risks to the species. I want to go back to the numbers. 366 remaining whales, about 94 reproductive females. Is that enough for recovery? And are they healthy enough for the species to recover? And I guess the corollary there is, where's the number that is the tipping point, where if we get down to that number, the species, I don't want to sound melodramatic, but the species could be doomed.
Well, I mean, the point where the species are doomed is an awful lot less than where we are now. They've been lower than this before, and they were increasing. So we know we can do that, and we have examples of lots of baleen whale populations around the world that have come back from outrageously low numbers. You know, unless you're getting down to less than half a dozen females, there's always a chance, and you've got to decide that you want to take that chance. And as you know, I mean, as for the rest, you know, it's, I mean, an issue is, you know, there's actually fewer females than males in the species now, and we need to focus on how many females there are. And that's obviously a scarier number than how many the entire species. But, you know, we know that marine mammals can come back from extraordinarily low numbers.
So that is encouraging. I want to come back to what is encouraging. But before we do, I want to stay in the scary space for a minute, because I do want to understand, should we lose this species, what do we lose in the ecosystem, you know, in the environment, et cetera?
Well, there's a couple of ways of looking at that. And one is, you know, the prosaic one of, well, what do the whales do for us? And we now know that baleen whales can be ecosystem engineers, that particularly in the Antarctic system where this is being best studied, you know, they produce a lot of iron in systems that are iron poor. And so they can encourage the growth of plankton simply by feeding and then coming to the surface, and they always poo on the surface because that's the way whales' bodies work. And their poo has a lot of iron in it, and so they're actually encouraging the growth of the things they need to eat. So there's a level at which more whales gives you more whale food, which is counterintuitive, but it does actually work. And that's, you know, a simple answer. And then there's another one, is the question of, well, what does it mean to lose a species? And particularly, what does it mean to lose such an iconic species that people have put so much time and effort into trying to save? And, you know, saving the whales was one of the first big successes of the conservation movement generally. And what does it say about us if we're prepared to let this species blink out from problems that we know we can solve?
So what are the immediate next steps? Let's say we're not ready for all the reasons you just laid out. What can science do to strengthen the female population, help with reproduction? Let's start there briefly, and then I think, you know, what can we do? Let's start
Well, what science has done, I mean, one of the really intriguing things that we've been able to show in the past few years is how important being entangled is, not just to killing whales, but to impacting their health and their capacity to have babies. You know, the way baleen whales work is females have to stack on a lot of fat to then get pregnant, to, you know, make the trip down to Florida, have a calf, and then swim back up not eating and having that calf suck energy out of the mother in the form of milk. And that's a big demand. And so they actually have to be healthy enough before they can even get pregnant in the first place. And we've shown recently that entanglement work, this is work led by Julie Vanderhoop, who was at Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, and she showed just how important being entangled is. Just the drag from pulling gear along affects the capacity of females to be able to have calves. So we've done a lot of really cool science to show what the problem is. And we actually know this species really well. So then it becomes a matter of will to, you know, implement the changes that are going to be needed to follow through on what we know can solve these problems.
And Peter, in a sentence, we're almost out of time. In a sentence, what's one thing that people listening could do differently right now?
Oh, contact their political representatives and let them know they care about whales.
Perfect. That is Peter Corcoran, the senior scientist and chair of the Marine Mammal Conservation Program at the New England Aquarium. Peter, I appreciate you giving us the time and the information today. Thanks.
Thank you very much.